You are listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guest studies some of the factors that shape our lives and ways of being in life, ideas, events, and what she refers to as traversing. Susanna Trinka is Associate Professor of Social Anthropology at the University of Auckland. She's the co-editor of Competing Responsibilities, The Politics and Social Ethics of Responsibility in Contemporary Life, and State of Suffering, Political Violence and Community Survival in Fiji.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Susanna Trinka. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with responsibility with you, because you've done this enormous range of subjects in your work. It's extraordinary the amount of subjects that you have covered, but responsibility was something that I had thought about, but the way you articulated what it has meant historically versus what it means now, I thought was quite fascinating. And this seems like the demarcation was neoliberalism. So walk us through responsibility and what neoliberalism has meant for it.
Okay. It depends on how many hours you have, I think. But for me, this project initially, I've written two books on responsibility. One is my book on asthma. So it's about children and asthma and sort of global notions of responsibility for health and well-being of children. And the other is an edited volume, which I edited with Catherine Trundle, and it's specifically looking at the concept of responsibility. It's called Competing Responsibilities. But for me, it began very much with the ethnography, with the Czech material, looking at children who were ill and looking at a medical system that was trying to shift the bulk of responsibility onto families and onto children themselves, and yet seeing there was such resistance, both in terms of the medical experts in the Czech Republic, who were, you know, almost kind of, in some cases, willing to do the rhetoric of responsabilization or personal responsibility for health, but not actually willing to actually engage with it because they felt, rightly or wrongly, that there was a reason for their expertise, there was a reason for their authority, and patients should be turning to them. But at the same time, there was a broader discourse around the state and the role of the state and of corporations, particularly corporations that are involved in environmental issues, environmental pollution. What is their responsibility more broadly for ensuring children and more broadly citizens' well-being?
It sounded like from one of the papers I read that you published on the subject that the meaning was sort of a ruse, like the idea, the concept of personal responsibility became a way of maybe selling notions that were embedded in neoliberalism. Would you say that's the case?
So what I try and do in both of the books is actually to try and complexify that, to say on the one hand, absolutely, but on the other hand, there have been real kind of activist movements around reshaping questions of expertise and authority, which are quite profound. So if you look at, because the asthma book looks at asthma in the Czech Republic and New Zealand, so if you look in New Zealand at what is commonly called self-management discourse around healthcare and asthma in particular, which is about sort of devolving responsibility onto the patient. They should self-manage their condition. Yes, some of that came from a reconfiguration of the healthcare budget, but a lot of it also came from activists in the 70s, parents who became very involved in sort of saying, we're tired of just doing what these doctors tell us to do. We know our children's conditions. We know what they need, and we need to have our voices heard. And so it was an interesting kind of move that came from two sides that has now ended up with this system where, yes, some families do feel very much empowered that they take responsibility for their children's health and well-being, but others feel that they're completely floundering. And often that's based on things like class and financial access and, you know, who can actually afford to go to the doctor when they need to and who has to take responsibility for themselves, whether they're capable or not.
And the cause of the conditions of asthma as well, like you mentioned, the
yes.
corporate pollution, the externalization of that into the public.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
And so there's maybe this notion of societal approaches to responsibility as well.
Absolutely. In
yeah.
both cases.
And how do you sort of parse that out and how have those meanings shifted?
So in New Zealand, in terms of asthma, it's there, but it's subdued. Let me put it that way. So there are moves towards we need to look at this collectively. And in particular around we need to look at issues of poverty and children's health more broadly. But you have respiratory physicians, for example, saying that. So it's within that domain of sort of asthma and respiratory health, but it's a much broader take on what is necessary to help make children's well-being, improve children's health. But you don't really have that kind of when you open the newspaper. You don't see that as a headline. You don't see big debates in Parliament. What was interesting to me in the Czech Republic was every week it would be on the radio, it would be in the news, it would be in Parliament that people were arguing, doesn't the state have a responsibility here to take care of these children? So what was interesting to me was, yes, we have that discourse in New Zealand if you go looking for it, but it's not kind of front and center. It hasn't captured the social imaginary.
So you think that is sort of the ethos of individualism?
I think so, absolutely. Yes.
And so would you argue that the ethos of individualism and individual responsibility is sort of a myth, given the complex nature of a problem like asthma?
Individual responsibility is held up as an ideal, and people strive towards it.
But is it truly possible?
Well, one of the things I argue in the book is that you can have responsibility, you can have sort of individual empowerment if you're supported, right? So you need a particular kind of state or a particular kind of society or familial relationships which enable you to then do things on your own, but you need that sort of foundation for it to occur. And sort of more broadly, these are the issues that we take up in the Competing Responsibilities book, where we really try and look at responsibility as a kind of catchword of neoliberal discourse and suggest actually the word and the concept and the way we engage with responsibility has a myriad of different meanings and has been around for much longer. And we're allowing kind of neoliberal rhetoric to take this word and turn it into something that it doesn't need to be that narrow. It can be a much broader concept that enables things like responsibility in terms of care for the other or citizen-state relations. And for me, that really came through in a kind of mundane example. One of my kids was at intermediate school, and the term project was responsibility. And I'd been thinking about these issues, and so I was very intrigued, and I was saying, so what are you learning? And basically, they were learning self-management. They were learning time management, how to get your homework in, how to motivate yourself, and all of these things that I thought of as responsibility for your classmates, responsibility for the school grounds, the stream that runs through the back of the grounds, responsibility for the well-being of, you know, the teacher or your family or your younger brother or sister. None of that was what they were being taught. And so they were learning in a very profound way.
In a very narrow way.
What is responsibility? It is responsabilization. It is responsibility for myself and taking care of myself and putting myself forward when it doesn't need to be that way. And that's what we're trying to argue.
I guess when I was asking about the mythology of the personal responsibility, because if we look at the world through that lens, it sort of dissolves the interconnectedness of,
yes,
of all of us and other members of society in terms of, well, problem causation and problem solution, for example, but really the construction of our social and political world altogether.
Yes, which is part of what Nicholas Rose has been arguing in his critique of responsibility discourse for some time, that it does sort of rest on this idea that if you can't actually make it and the state's not going to help you, there will be a family or there will be some set of interrelations that will help you through that. But that's the sort of quiet side of it that doesn't get explored. And we're trying to say that's actually quite fundamental to how we think about responsibility is care for the other and citizen-state relations.
Yeah, so care is a key concept that you talked about.
Yes.
So care for the other, care in terms of the community, care for maybe even if you go broader to sort of humanity or planetary care.
Yes.
So how can we use that in competition with this? Like you mentioned, it's hardly discussed in traditional media. It's hardly brought up in this way. It doesn't really fit media norms, like news norms, to talk about these non-specific, hard, ideas. You know, it's easy to cover a fire,
Well, I guess that was what was so interesting to me about the asthma situation, was that you had similar medical possibilities, so similar kinds of levels of technology and systems of care in place in both countries. You had not wildly dissimilar rates. There's a lot more asthma in New Zealand among children than there is in the Czech Republic, but it's not like it was a completely different black and white situation. And yet the way people were talking about it, the way they conceptualized asthma as a problem. So what is the problem of asthma? When you talk to people in New Zealand, a lot of particularly people who aren't sort of competing mainstream definitions, the problem tends to be people aren't using their medication appropriately. And if they use their inhalers appropriately, then there would be a lot less anguish and problematics around asthma. Then you have a few sort of counter people who are saying, actually, the problem is with the pharmaceutical industry, which is trying to make us take our inhalers more than we need to. And that's something I explore in the book. But when I came to the Czech Republic and I asked people, you know, there's a lot of talk about asthma. What really is the issue here? They said the issue is that people are passive and they're not taking an active role. And I said, you know, in terms of their medication? No, in terms of being citizens, in terms of pushing the government and saying to the government, this is an issue that is, you know, foremost on our minds and you need to act. So essentially the problem was the government response. But again, in that interesting way that personal responsibility gets brought in, a lot of the activists were saying the problem is with people. But it wasn't people taking responsibility for themselves or their own health. It was people taking responsibility for the collective, for the state. People should be out there, they were saying, out on the streets demanding government do something. Because individually, they said, we can't solve this problem. We need a collective solution. And the only force that there is that has enough kind of influence and power to make this happen collectively is the government. But to me, it was fascinating because you had government, you had corporations that were involved with the air pollution, and then you had people taking self-responsibility, but self-responsibility to move a collective position. And I thought, this is completely different than when my kid is sitting there going, ah, responsibility is about time management and getting my homework in on time. But the same set of concepts being deployed differently.
Right. On the same issue.
On the same issue.
Yeah, and which then you can take and put on top of almost every issue.
So that's what we're trying to do in the other book, the book on responsibility, to suggest this isn't just about one issue. This is about a myriad of different places where we think, how are we going to conceptualize this? And even in terms of responsibility, we can conceptualize it radically different ways.
Right. So we're speaking with Susanna Trinka. She's an associate professor at the University of Auckland in anthropology. Now, you've also covered political violence and the aftermath of political violence. Perhaps we should turn to that. You focused on an island nation of Fiji. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should start with a little reminder of what happened politically in Fiji.
Well, I was in Fiji in 1999 and 2000, and I was doing research. Actually, all of my work pretty much looks at questions of embodiment and politics of the body. That's kind of where I start. And in this case, I was looking at issues of pain among Indo-Fijian communities. And again, trying to look at children, though that never got written up, but that was the initial impetus, was to look about how children talk about pain and how it's nested in sort of familial and societal and medical discourses. And I was obviously very aware of Fiji's turbulent political history. But at that point, things had been very peaceful for quite some time, and no one was sort of expecting an outbreak of any major political turbulence, much less political violence. And then in May of 2000, there was a major coup, and members of the parliament were held hostage, and there was a shooting around the capital and other parts of the country. And what followed was several months of great turbulence and quite a bit of personal violence, often directed, but not always directed, but often directed towards members of the Indo-Fijian community, which was the group that I was predominantly spending my time with and living in a small village that was predominantly Indo-Fijian. And I still remember sort of walking home from the medical center where I'd been doing observations, looking. At that point, I'd realized I needed to go beyond children to look more generally at how people cope with physical pain. And they had shut the medical center and they'd sent everyone home. And I was walking through this little town watching the greengrocers and other small business people boarding up their stores. And I couldn't get a taxi. And it was just sort of utter chaos. And I really had absolutely no idea why. And then finally, when I got home, I found out that there'd been this major political overturning, a political coup.
So they knew about it, but you didn't.
The news was slowly percolating through various networks. And because I was in a situation where I wasn't with my friends, I'd been adopted by a family at that point. I wasn't with them. I was in a professional situation in the medical center where I didn't have such close ties. I didn't quite find out for some time until I got home and then, you know, heard that it had been on the radio. My husband had gone to pick up our daughter from school because the school had closed down. A few weeks later, the school was actually burnt down. We made the mistake of going to see what it looked like because there were so many rumors and we didn't know what was accurate and what was not. So we'd heard the school had burnt down. And this was first child. You probably wouldn't do this with later children. We put her in the car and we drove her over to take a look. And so she saw that her school had been burnt down to the ground, which was not good.
Yeah, what was her response?
Yeah. I think the response is that it really was one of those where things have changed radically in the course of an hour. And your way of being, your way of moving through time and relating to events was completely different for the next 5 or 6 months. It was about being on your toes and figuring out when do you need to run and where do you run. And I was pregnant at the time, so that wasn't particularly helpful either. So, but, you know, we were much better off than many of the people we were living with. But it was an interesting experience. For someone interested in embodiment, those 5 or 6 months will always sort of stay with me, what that actual experiential side of doing work in a place and time in those conditions.
You called it a state of suffering, right? Mm. So which has that double entendre, both it being a state,
yes,
and being a personal state,
yes,
or a,
yes,
communal state,
yes,
of suffering. And you told the story partly through a woman that you called Shanti, mm-hmm, and how Shanti's life changed at that moment. And all of what used to be normal suddenly became something else, like normalcy changed,
yes,
across the community.
Yes.
So how would you describe that, and how would you put that into your bigger context?
I don't think it links so much to the responsibility question, but to the question of embodiment, the sort of phenomenology of living in a time. And it wasn't even so much the violence per se as the sense of uncertainty. And I think what really struck me was the way people were trying to find new frameworks. And there was a framework out there. There was a framework of ethnic violence, right? This is Indians versus Fijians. And a lot of people were drawing on these deeply racist caricatures. And it was from both sides, indigenous Fijians and Indo-Fijians were sort of deploying these stories of these are the fundamental differences between us and them, and that's why this is occurring. But at the same time, as I explore in the book, that only went so far as to explain certain circumstances. So people would deploy these rhetorics, just talk generally about this is why these things are happening in Fiji. And then they would say, and this is what happened to my aunt or my cousin or me or whoever. And we were there and they were going to come. And, you know, there was always the they, right? They were going to come and they were going to burn down our house. These are Indo-Fijian stories I'm sort of replicating here. And then this indigenous Fijian friend of mine would come and say, you better run. And I would say, but, you know, you're saying it's us versus them, but the person who's come to put you in a car and driven you somewhere or put you in a lorry and hidden you under kind of sacks of things so you look like your agricultural produce being driven from one place to another. I mean, it's the extent that people were helping each other move from one site that was thought
Within both communities.
Yes.
Helping each other.
Well, Indo-Fijians tended to be bearing the brunt of the violence. Mm. So it tended to be Indigenous Fijians
who were helping
to get people out or warning them. So they would tell these stories and you'd be like, but what you've just told kind of undermines the whole narrative of it's us versus them. And so one of the chapters I look at in the book is about friendship and the understanding of what is friendship, particularly when it crosses these different ethnic divides or seeming divides. And then I also look at just various other moments where the kind of ethnic difference construction, the narrative, just completely falls apart and people can't use that to make sense of events. And then what are they using? Well, sometimes they were watching, you know, Xena Warrior Princess on TV or Alice in Wonderland, somebody was quoting in the newspaper. They were drawing on whatever sort of narrative frameworks or conceptual devices they could to try and make sense of what is happening and, very importantly, what is likely to happen next.
To get that certainty that was missing suddenly.
Or maybe not certainty, but try and come closer to a good guess. Because things were happening like at 2 a.m, the guy that lived next to us rang us and said, George Speight was the guy that engineered the coup. He said, Speight's men are coming. They're going to set up camp in the school that was right next to our house. It was bordering, the schoolyard was bordering our back garden. You have to get out now. And we were like, it's 2 a.m. You know, we're under curfew. Where are we going to go? So you had to assess, is that a real threat? Should I really be running, or is it safer to stay in my home? In my case, I gave birth during this time. I had to assess, is it safe to get in a car to drive to the main hospital, which has much better facilities, or should I be going to the local tiny little clinic? We were told it was safe to go into the city, even though it was after curfew. So we got in the car when I was in labor and we started driving after curfew and I got stopped twice. And twice when I was having contractions, I got questioned by very young military men with machine guns saying, why aren't you going to the local hospital? And I'm having contractions and trying to, you know, and I'm thinking in my head, but people said this was going to be safe. People said they won't stop a woman in labor. Well, guess again, that was the wrong assessment to have made. You know, so it was that sort of, and I'm drawing on my own ones because they're the ones I know the best, but obviously everybody in the community was making these assessments. I have a small business in this rural area. Is it safe to stay there? Should I shift my family? Is it safe maybe just for the menfolk to stay there and the women to leave? But where would they go? And if they go here or there, maybe that place will suddenly become unsafe.
So the key in organizing life was around safety.
Yes.
And another key in making sense and talking that you said in the book was around pain.
Yes, that was a broader discourse, which was there. So the question of safety was the really pertinent one on those days where you felt like things were extraordinarily volatile and you literally didn't know geographically, should I be here or should I be there? Can I, you know, the schools have reopened. Can I actually send my kid there? Or in the time it would take me to go to the school and pick her up, if something happened, would I not be able to get there? Right. So that was in that kind of immediate framing. There was a larger issue there, which was the issue that had interested me initially when I came to look at children and pain, which was that Indo-Fijian discourse in particular really focused on issues of pain and the importance of suffering and giving your all physically, giving your all to build the nation. And this was part of the heritage of Indo-Fijians having initially been brought as indentured servants from India to work on sugarcane plantations where the conditions were extremely brutal. And so you had the descendants of those people kind of embracing and valorizing this history. And you can see in a politically divisive context where there was a lot of rhetoric against Indo-Fijians as sort of foreigners who don't belong in Fiji. Fiji should belong to the indigenous people. This was the kind of return rhetoric, the counter rhetoric, which was, our forefathers were brought here, they suffered, they sweated, they bled to make the sugar plantations grow. They built the economy of this country. And so therefore, we have a right to stay here. And that was there from the first day I arrived and all through the coup, where it got heightened as people are feeling threatened. You know, they start to sort of raise their claim and say, actually, we have a right to be here. And you can see that manifest in the way that we and our forefathers and foremothers have suffered for this nation. And it has certainly continued since then.
So I would guess that a lot of this type of contextualization can be overlaid into many conflicts.
I will allow you to make that assessment because I never set off to be an anthropologist of political violence. It's kind of the last thing I wanted to do. And I was sort of thrust into this situation and decided it was sort of my ethical responsibility to document it because I'd been there for a year and a half when this happened and I knew the community really well. I mean, I'm making it sound like I sat there and justified it. It was just, this has happened, I need to write about it. It wasn't actually that thought through. It was more, this is happening to people, it needs to be documented. Obviously, when I went to write the book, I looked at other situations, but I never sort of made political violence my area that I want to continue focusing on.
Thank you now, Susanna Trinka, for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much.
Susanna Trinka is Associate Professor of Social Anthropology at the University of Auckland. She's the co-editor of Competing Responsibilities, The Politics and Social Ethics of Responsibility in Contemporary Life, and State of Suffering, Political Violence and Community Survival in Fiji.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.